Baby Pictures of Famous Dictators podcast, episode 15. Talking Gone Girl, my friend Tandy.
Hi.
Hi, Tandy. Tandy's a fiction fellow at the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas and a former lawyer from London.
Yes, fancy.
If they can't tell by your accent, although I guess it's not a London accent.
No, it's very much not a London accent.
What accent do you say you have?
It's an accent with identity confusion. It doesn't know
perfect
what it is.
For Gone Girl. Yeah. So let's jump right in. What were your general impressions of the movie?
I thought it was a terrible movie.
Sure. Usually what I do is I'll bring in someone who has, you know, opposite opinion that I have on a movie.
Right.
But since I was sort of indifferent, I had very low expectations having read the book. Your opinion differs from mine, just that I was indifferent towards this hateful movie, and you really didn't like it.
I think I wanted more from David Fincher, and I think I was also surprised by how bad it was. It was bad as a film.
That's important for art too. Surprise you.
It was bad. For the first time, I felt like a David Fincher movie went on for double the amount of time it should have gone on for.
Have you seen The Curious Case of Benjamin Button?
I haven't seen. Perhaps that's.
It suffers from a similar disorder.
But I also think it was a troubling movie, and I haven't read the book. But I guess we'll get into all. Oh,
we're
going to
elaborate on how troublesome a movie this is. But I guess the central question is, how self-aware is the movie about that troublesome nature? Because it does at least feign or nod its head toward balancing camp and drama and suspense and psychological thriller, as you have observed, probably to bad effect.
Well, I don't think the movie is self-aware at all. No. I think it's one of the worst problems I thought with it is that it's a really sincere movie. And it's trying to make you believe in it in a way which I think is just not possible for the film's plot. Actually, camp is interesting because after the movie, I had a discussion with other people. Some people thought it was a really camp film.
Sure.
I did not think it was.
I also did not think it was.
I mean, you need, like, self-awareness for camp.
There were nods toward it, as I said. The robot dog, of course, is a camp. But I think that was put more in as a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
Through all the direness, you know.
Yeah.
He has an invented robot dog obsession, which is, in my mind, very funny and campy. But that's never put forward in such a manner that you believe that's the tone of the movie.
No, and the movie's not. There's no sense of artifice to it. There's no kind
very
of,
little.
Like, I'm, like, obviously thinking of Susan Sontag's definition of camp, but I think she would say that there has to be self-awareness and there has to be artifice and there has to be exaggeration. And the movie's not aware of its own exaggeration. It's a ridiculous movie, but it takes that all so
very
seriously.
Very sincerely. Which is a problem. I think the counterexample that I gave would be American Psycho.
Right.
That movie, which takes the ridiculousness of the plot and plays it both for high comedy and sort of intense social commentary. And this movie, I think, fails as both of those. So
yeah. I think this movie really wanted the viewer to be moved by it. Or affected by it.
Emotionally?
To think even serious thoughts
after
it. And I thought serious thoughts, but not the thoughts that I think it intended.
Which is a problem.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a testament to the movie's, the intellectual worth of the movie. So this is also a more general question, but like as an aspiring fiction writer, how does it make you feel? Does it affect you at all? Do you think it speaks to the wider literary community that this book sold millions and millions of copies? Do you think about those things at all? Does it...
No, I think anybody who can sell a shitload of copies of a book, like, great. Like, if they can, put, exactly. Like, I think if James Patterson is continuously selling millions of books and living in his big house in Florida and making money off it, who cares about the quality?
He's the leader in the war against Amazon. We need
exactly. So I mean, I haven't read the book. I think congratulations to Gillian Flynn for selling what would appear to be not a great book to thousands of people. I don't know if most people would have read the book. Having not read it, I'm not sure if most people would have read the book as seriously as the film presented it. And if they didn't, if they just read it for entertainment, I think it's problematic entertainment.
Yeah.
But that's fine. Like,
but
I'm not gonna,
nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm not going to begrudge someone's like beach holiday reading of Gone Girl. But I don't think it's something perhaps to aspire to, just yeah. based on the film.
I think it's manipulative in all the wrong ways, because both the book and the movie present her diary as fact.
Yes.
When in, you know, the author or the movie itself knows that it is, in fact, a farce.
Yeah.
And so when one of your characters knows a lot more than your audience, it becomes troublesome. It's less suspense, because you want your characters, I think, to be placed in a state of unknowing.
Right.
Equal to the audience. And since there's a character who always is not even one step ahead, but just, like, born one step ahead, it's problematic for me.
And I can't remember it now, but I'm not sure if we find out that the diary is fake through Ben Affleck's character. I think that would legitimize it a little bit.
Yeah, the movie reveals it. It's when she's in the car and she says, faking your own death is tough or whatever.
It kind of had the feeling of, like, someone was making a TV show and they had 5 minutes left of the TV show and they have to reveal that so that it just suddenly was revealed.
Sure.
And I think because we don't come to know it in the film through the characters, that's a problem too. I was actually felt surprised and annoyed at that part of the film when that reveal happened.
Yes,
and then even more when I realized there was, like, still 45 hours of the film left to go.
Which would be fine, but it seems to almost derail the movie in a way, because you don't care what happens to Ben Affleck or her by that point in the movie, because she is obviously a very damaged sociopath and he is a philandering liar.
And actually, I have a question for you.
Sure.
I was thinking about the unlikability of both characters.
Sure.
I think Ben Affleck's character is marginally more likable.
In the grand scheme,
than
certainly.
The Amy character. And I know that doesn't matter in fiction, but I wonder if it matter more in film?
Well, I think it's a lot easier to, I mean, when you're putting beautiful people on the screen, we automatically romanticize them and give them more credit than they're due, I think, especially Ben Affleck, because one of the, I think, strongest points of the movie is the casting.
Yes.
And how they either play against type or play, like, the most heinous aspects that we think of, like, Ben Affleck and, I guess, Rosamund Pike. I'm not familiar with her work, but I'm sure people are bringing connotations to her work as well. But Tyler Perry, Neil Patrick Harris, these are people who obviously represent something in our culture, and they are not buying into that, really. So, like, Ben Affleck, I read one review that says he's the type of person who, when he smiles, he never smiles with his eyes.
Yeah.
The rest of his face is a smile, and it's always this, you, like, linger and wonder what's going on behind him. So he is maybe a more suspect leading man than other ones.
I also think that there's something in film about either not sympathizing, but understanding a character.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand.
Well,
I understood.
This movie provides very little opportunities for you to understand the characters at all.
Exactly.
Like, from the moment the relationship starts, they're lying to each other. And we're going to get into, like, what's the takeaway of this film. But it's really hard to have a takeaway when your characters are just, like, blanks.
But there's also not a villain you love to hate. And I think that's a trait of successful film villains, that you are reveling in their evil to some degree. And this is not the villain of this story, the Amy character, is not someone you're really that impressed by when she does all her fucked up stuff. I mean, I was impressed mildly by the logistics of it.
The logistics are absolutely impossible, which I think goes against the...
But I wasn't impressed by her as a psychological being. The same I'd be impressed by Hannibal Lecter or...
Sure.
I have a lot to say, by the way, about Disney villains related to Gone Girl.
Do you want to do that now, or should we segue later?
I mean, I read a review of it on interrogatingmedia.com.
We'll give them a shout out, sure.
You
can link to this if you'd like.
Yeah, which I found very helpful. And the writer had linked to Gillian Flynn's interviews where she's talking about why she wrote this female character. And she said that she really wanted a good female villain. And she thought that good female villains were lacking. And, I mean, she also said some other things. She said she's tired of, I think, brave or honorable rape victims, which is a strange comment to make. But she...
aren't we all, though?
But she, you know, she really had this idea that she was going to create this really, and I guess this is going into the next thing, it's really strong, feminist,
complex antagonist,
villain.
Which I don't think this character
is
at all.
I don't think so either. And then I thought about, well, who has created a strong female villain? And I realized Disney has
Cruella
done a much
DeVille.
Better job. Yeah, because the female villains in Disney movies, well, I guess Cruella de Vil just wants a coat. But, but you know, Ursula from The Little Mermaid wants power.
Sure. Turn this off.
The villain of Frozen, we understand, come to understand that she's not really a villain. It's kind of weird to me that Disney's animated films have created arguably more successful.
Well, almost on the whole, they always do, especially villains. The Pixar department. Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, not to say that, Disney's not bad at, Disney's bad at, making films, because I don't think they are, but Disney has a troubled history with females.
Certainly.
And if Disney's kind of more successful...
When they gave breast implants to the poor yeah. brave girl against her, will.
I think when Disney is more successful than this film, that's a problem.
And this film will be nominated for Best Picture. And
exactly.
Although I guess Beauty and the Beast was nominated for Best Picture.
That was a great film.
Masterpiece. But in terms of antagonists, I'm sure Gillian Flynn would maybe forward the argument that marriage is the institution of marriage is the villain, or this, like, I don't even know, this white class of, like, charming, clever New Yorkers who are really full of shit and they're sycophants and
right.
like that's to blame in the media culture. And
well, that's where I think the film failed at being camp, because if it had taken those, or the book, whichever one it originates from, but sure. if it had taken those elements and really exaggerated them and showed us the artifice of those, yeah. which I think it made a half-hearted attempt at doing, then that would have been more successful.
Yeah. It just traffics in so many generalities about class and women and men.
Yes.
And I mean, the outlook is so cynical that it's really hard to give the movie any credence beyond that.
And I also think the time... there's a lot of great, and I can't name one now, but there's, I think the time for great marriage movies was the 1950s, the 1960s, sure. when marriage was a really accepted social institution that wasn't questioned. I don't think people feel that tied to the idea of marriage anymore.
No, that certainly doesn't get across.
That it needs to be interrogated in the way that Gillian Flynn...
She seems to half interrogate everything, and as I said, traffic in generalities above specificity. My, like, microcosmic moment is when the police are first checking the house, and they find the blood on the stove, and they're like, oh, someone mopped here, and then they go into her office, and there's, like, the Harvard degree on the wall, and right. they're all, like, looking at it with, like, sparkles coming out of their eyes, like, oh, she's smarter than everyone in this town.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, just because she went to Harvard doesn't make her any less of an idiot.
And as if only rich people from New York City can yes. go to Harvard, which is...
Well, no, that's actually true.
Well, I think the movie had so many, in terms of the marriage, we don't actually know why they got married. There's that scene in the...
They're both equally revolting. The things right. that they say to each other in their supposed meet cute are things that if someone were throwing those lines at me, I would turn the other way and shoot myself.
Yeah. That was maybe that just served to show that these two people were meant for each other, because that came across
in that respect,
artificial.
The book is a work of genius. Yeah. It's just these two frauds who deserve to kill each other.
If we want to think about the movie as, you know, questioning what's wrong with marriage, then I think we need to know why they got into the marriage. We kind of see her writing in her fake diary, I wish I could be married. And then the next thing you know, yeah. he's suddenly randomly in a party decided to propose. And we don't actually know where that decision comes from. So we can't
Well, they,
go
they
into
kiss
the,
in the fake in the powder
sugar.
Snow. In the
yeah,
sugar.
That's marriage.
There is a very big gap between, or at least a blank spot between them meeting and him proposing yeah. that. I don't know if it would help the movie because the characters are so insufferable.
Yeah, I just think that, like, because I think it goes back to what you said about not knowing. We actually don't know yeah. what's real for most of this movie. So we can't really feel a real effect from it yeah. because we weren't provided
sure.
with the kind of emotional grounding.
Like, you're supposed to be on unsteady ground in these type of movies, yeah. but it's, I don't think you're ever given a ground to begin with, and so you just kind of fall through the thing. Wondering.
No.
Which is a problem.
Yeah, it is a problem.
Do you think, like, on terms of the believability, do you think that a plot such as this is aided by being on the screen or on the page?
Well, do you know if the book is written in the first or third person?
The book is written in alternating first person from Amy's right. point of view and then Nick's.
Okay. I think that, first of all, I think you have to be a great writer to pull this type of plot off.
Yeah. The plot... in its defense, is very intricate,
yes.
cuckoo clock plotted.
It is.
Twisty turns, if that's your bag.
I assume it's going to be more believable on the page because a novel just offers more opportunity than a film. Or especially a film of this kind where it's not deeply, intensely focused on one character. But a novel offers more opportunity to get into a character's motivations and to understand their psychology. This film very much felt always that we were looking in from the outside. It never really got close to any of the characters, I think. With Amy a few times, but by then she's so evil and the things she's explaining are so evil, we have no
investment.
Yeah, and we didn't build up to that. Yeah. We're just like, oh, she's an evil bitch. Like,
that's do you think all we that know. Would have improved the book, though, if there was some sort of Freudian explanation? Well, I guess the Freudian explanation is her parents writing that book about her.
Right. I can't say about the book. I just assume that the work was taken in the book to establish a character who believably does these things, which in the movie, it wasn't. It was just a sort of... I think Fatal Attraction has more character believability
sure.
than this does. I don't think you ever see her as so desperate or so manipulative. So when it comes, it's not entirely believable. And I think you can hit a balance. You don't have to tell us everything about why she's doing what she's doing.
Particularly taking place in the present day, the believability goes way down. I think if this was set in the 80s, it would be...
Yeah, for something... I mean, the 80s was full of psychos. So
that everyone was on coke and yeah. wanting to kill each other. But, I mean, even the part where she's in the ex-boyfriend's house, his lake house, and there's cameras through the entire house.
Right.
And she's... I don't even understand the impetus behind it, but she's, like, throwing herself against the glass, pretend that he raped her.
Yeah.
But there's an entire... I mean, this video doesn't exist, but there should be a video of her, like, sitting around in the table.
Exactly.
And then standing up, like, putting the fake blood between her legs and throwing herself against the glass.
I actually thought for
but
some...
But I think, like, poking holes in this movie's plot is kind of a worthless ordeal.
It's yeah, there's so many potential holes.
But I think that's related to the likability, too, and, like, I think the argument you always need to put forth as a writer is you don't want your characters to be likable, you want them to be engaging, and it doesn't
right.
matter.
And you want there to be... You want there to be some way in which people don't need to sympathize with them.
But they need to understand.
They need to understand. I also, just talking about the bit in Lake House, for some reason, Neil Patrick Harris's character to me was the most... I was able to connect with him the most. I understood him the most. I don't know if that's just because Neil Patrick Harris is the greatest actor. No, greatest actor
because he can
of our
dance
generation.
So well.
Because he... Or the very, like, pained facial expressions. Yeah. He was... delivering throughout.
Well, I think we see the tragedy of his existence
yes.
in his, you know, pursuit of this person who we know is a full-blown psychopath.
Yeah, so...
well, he's sort of a psychopath, too, but...
Well, he's a more understandable psychopath.
In a more endearing way.
I mean, he's like the kind of psychopath you'd run into every day on the street.
Our favorite. So let's go about the aboutness. Do you think there is a message to take away from this movie, or is it pure entertainment and just meant to, you know, divert you for 6.5 hours while you watch it?
I think certainly from what I've read of Gillian Flynn's...
Oof.
Yes. I think she certainly thinks there's this movie's about something. I think she thinks it's about women, it's about marriage, and I think she had strong views on that. I think the movie... delivers an entirely different message. And I actually think it delivers its problematic message to the extent that it can't just be watched as entertainment. Because it's so...
You have to wonder about the wider societal pathology right. that this movie represents.
Well, also because you can't really sit back and enjoy it. You can't just sit back and think, well, it's a little bit, like, fucked up, but, like, I'm still enjoying it anyway. Yeah. It hammers you over the head repeatedly with its plot. So that you have to take notice of that. And because it takes itself so seriously.
Yeah.
So you really can't just remove yourself from it and enjoy it in any way but what it wants.
Yeah, I imagine it would be, like, her idea of it would be that it's the question of, can you ever really know someone?
Yes.
Or can you ever really know a person, but the people that she gives you aren't people. It's not a person. It's just, like, two... generalizations, like generalized ideas of men and women and romance, and almost everything in the book is just like shorthand for what we accept from TV and the internet.
Right.
It's just these ideas of men and women.
And we never see them really knowing each other. We
no.
never see them lulled
but
into a false sense
The movie makes like a big thing about this, that he doesn't know that she's hanging out with this woman every day and
right.
that he's having an affair. And like, these are things that if you actually were married to someone in an isolated place where you knew, like, you didn't know anyone, you would find these things out about each other.
And in fact, the only time we get of them having like a kind of rapport, I guess, is that initial meet cute. And that's sure. insufferable. So, you know, you don't feel in that moment like here are two people who've made a genuine connection.
Yeah.
And then you don't feel the betrayal of that connection later because there appears to be no connection whatsoever. No. The only connection I could see is that here are two, like, attractive people that found each other.
Sure.
And that's the connection.
She was a quiz writer.
He yeah. was a oh, yeah, they have that,
lifestyle
too.
Lifestyle magazine. That these characters are writers is maybe a really fascinating meta comment on the yeah. literary community, but...
And that they describe themselves as writers.
Yeah. She lives off her parents' whacked-out books. There's a troubled relationship of literature, I think. Because, I mean, there's a children's book that factors in. They're both right. writers. He alludes often to the novel that he's writing,
yes.
and then when the police the police officer goes into his office and finds, like, novel ideas, his little box, and there's panties in it.
there's no novel ideas.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's another, like, opportunity to
For
tell
camp.
Us something.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah, and it doesn't... Whatever it was trying to say about literature is also very... It's kind of like the movie thought, let's just put some stuff about literature in here and
yeah.
it'll make a comment. But I'm not clear what that comment was meant to be.
No.
In any
Unless
way.
The grand comment was that Gone Girl is true literature.
Potentially, but...
then she would be wrong. Do you find the film to be misogynistic? Why or why not?
I do, and I think it's... So I think there's, like... The type of argument people who are going to say it's not misogynistic are going to make is that, well, it's just one woman, and how can she represent every woman? And there's other female characters in the movie. There's the sister, there's the police officer, and they're not presented in the same way that the psychopathic Amy is presented. I think the context is really important.
The sister is a dupe. I mean, the sister
right.
is a giant dupe. The police
yeah.
officer, I guess, is the most complicated woman in the movie.
Yeah, and again, going back to that really great Interrogating Media review, it really watches like the extended nightmare of a group of, like, men's rights activists.
Exactly right.
Like a litany of, like, the things they would complain that, you yeah. know, like warning, like some kind of Reddit post, like, women might do this to you,
yeah.
and... They would, you know, here's things women would do to you. First, they'd, like, emasculate you by being rich and by earning more money than you and having your home in their name and your car in their name and the credit card in their name. And I think the male police officer character actually says in the movie, like, oh, that's embarrassing for him,
yeah.
the Ben Affleck character, when they figure that out. Then they're going to... I guess marry you, which there's no good explanation for.
A fate worse than death.
Then they're going to be unsupportive of you. They're going to want their, like, fancy lifestyle that's based on money. And when you have to move to take care of your sick mother, they're going to resent that. Because they only married you for, I guess, the money you bring in as a male magazine quiz writer.
Because you didn't have a mother.
Whatever you were doing. Then they're going to lie about abuse. They're going to pretend to be afraid of you. And then they're going to fake a rape. And then they're going to frame you. And then ultimately, they're going to
get pregnant.
So that you marry them forever
and
ever.
Yeah.
And even if they hate you, they'd rather be pregnant and married. Than miserable.
Than happy and single
exactly.
and childless. Which is a horrifying message to send to people, even if it is, if the book can be defended, in the book's defense, that she is just one woman.
Right, but there's such a narrative of rape victims lying.
Yeah, no, it literally corroborates the idea that there is, when someone is accused of rape or abuse, that there is an equal possibility that the woman is making it up as the
yes.
man is actually abusing her, which is ludicrous.
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking ludicrous. It's not like there's a card
yeah.
that some woman is, like, pulling out. She's like, oh, you've infuriated me, and she just yeah. takes it out. It's like the rape card.
And that exactly, that any time you upset a woman, the one power that the woman always has over you is that she can lie about being raped
yeah.
or abused. And I guess in that way, like, the marriage is not a marriage. It's presented that marriage can't be a marriage of equals.
Sure.
It's a marriage of, I guess, a tyrant.
And yeah, ludicrous power
captain.
Dynamics,
yeah.
which is a completely sick relationship to begin with, and why should we be invested in it?
And we don't actually ever find out the poor, like, lumbering, kind of, like, confused Ben Affleck character is sort of clueless throughout the whole thing. We get the impression that she's tricked him into all of this, which in itself doesn't make sense because presumably if she's that powerful, she could have chosen a better target than the Ben Affleck's character in this film. But I think, so I think it has to be seen in that context. Also, as far as the other characters are concerned, I think the most important thing is all of the characters that Ben Affleck's character wants to have sex with are manipulative. Right down to the woman who, there's that scene where a woman forces her to take a picture with him.
Sure.
And she's presented as a ludicrously highly sexualized character. But he doesn't want to have sex with his sister. He doesn't want to have sex with the police officers. So those females are...
And why would anyone have sex with his sister?
Right. Because she doesn't wear... Well, she wears movie makeup, but she doesn't wear makeup. Yeah. She wears men's t-shirts, and she's not, like, that conventionally pretty...
It's like a scary gender normative nightmare that this book takes place in, and that it's that it could ever be, like, thrown ahead as, like, a source of female empowerment is kind of horrifying.
It's just the opposite. And we haven't talked about the Blurred Lines girl.
Oh, the Blurred Lines girl, who I'm sure people be like, but wait, his mistress, like, stands up for herself and she outs him, but she does exactly what the Tyler Perry character predicts she will do. He's like, this idiot's going to go up there and out you, so we need to get out there beforehand.
Right. And the other female characters in the news, or well, I guess the fake Nancy Grace type.
I like that character.
And they're just evil. And then, of course, there's the evil motel woman.
I think
that's more.
Well, they have the most successful relationship in the entire movie. Like, they get exactly what they wanted.
Yeah. So I do think it's misogynistic.
I agree. You have a background in law. What do you? Yes. What's your views on the Tyler Perry performance and the legal implications of this entire thing? And do you think like people wouldn't be wise to this?
I think. Well, first of all, I didn't see that character as a lawyer. I just saw it as Tyler Perry has opened a law firm for himself and he's practicing law. In one way, there was something a little bit true about his portrayal of a defense lawyer, I think. At least
the PR management part of it?
Well, I think that's very different between America and England. But many of the defense lawyers I've known have this kind of attitude of like, it's crazy that they arrested you. Like, who the fuck are they to arrest you? Like, they really get into that sort of, you know, like, yeah, you were found with, like, 16 bodies or something, but, you know, how dare they? And I think that's a really great thing for a defense lawyer. I think all defense lawyers should be like that. I also think that my main problem was that Tyler Perry's character continuously holds conferences with his client in very public places. This is a major case, and their first conference is in the lobby of his building when he clearly has an office upstairs, so I'm not sure what the
Also, I don't understand why Ben Affleck goes to see him in person. He could very easily call him over the phone.
Exactly. He wants to have a discussion in a crowded cafe where they're shouting at each other. Like, that kind of...
And that's almost received information from movies, I think, too. That, like, when you're discussing sensitive information, you need to be in public so they can't tap your phones
exactly.
and stuff. Exactly. It's a complete farce.
Other than that, I mean, I guess there's not much lawyering going on.
If you were charged with defending Nick Dunn, would you have taken the case?
Yes, I think.
You think he's innocent?
Well, I mean, we know he's innocent, but at least in the jurisdiction I'm from, you have to take every case that's given to you unless there's a reason. So I would. But I think that would be... I mean, the good thing about the movie is it didn't actually take that case into the courtroom because it would have been absolutely ridiculous to portray that.
Smart on Julian's part. If, you know, they have that perfect system of hate that sustains their marriage at the end of the movie into perpetuity, but if they did get divorced and their child, which they don't really play this up in the movie, but she, like, impregnates herself with, like, a turkey baster.
Yes.
Which is...
And a stolen...
With his like frozen semen that he's been keeping in the back of their mini fridge, I suppose. Yeah. His man cave, because he has a man cave, because all men do. If you were then, do you think, if they were in like child custody court 10 years down the line, who would have gotten the child?
I have absolutely no idea. I don't think that either of these people should be raising a child.
I would nominally say
probably Ben Affleck is slightly more capable of raising a child, only because he didn't slit a man's throat open and lie about. but, I mean, this is, I would hate to think of the child that's produced from this union and this unhappy marriage.
Where's that sequel? I imagine it's that child in Looper who becomes the Antichrist and can smash things with his mind.
It's very possible there'll be a I'm thinking of that terrible Donnie Darko sequel. Gone Girl.
I don't think the words terrible and Donnie Darko belong in the same sentence.
Did you see the sequel?
I did not see Donnie Darko.
Yeah, it's very bad. But I think that there might be potentially a really even worse Gone Girl 2. Child of Gone Girl.
Gone Baby?
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird, because there's Ben Affleck's movies called Gone Baby Gone.
That's true.
So maybe that's
maybe he's setting up a franchise.
So I'm going to read there's a popular passage from the book called the Cool Girl passage that I think presents a lot of the arguments and generalities that are at the core of this book. So I'm going to read it now.
Okay.
So, she's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I am a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, and who plays video games, drinks cheap beer, loves threesomes and anal sex, and jams hot dogs and hamburgers into her mouth like she's hosting the world's biggest culinary gangbang while somehow maintaining a size 2. Because cool girls are above all hot. Hot and understanding. Cool girls never get angry. They only smile in a chagrin, loving manner and make their men do whatever they want. Go ahead, shit on me. I don't mind. I'm the cool girl. How much do you agree with that passage in Steve relationships?
I don't agree with it. I think because most of the people I know are sane.
Okay.
And, I mean,
well, that doesn't help.
I think that, like, there's an element of course, people curate their personalities at the start of a relationship.
Yeah.
I don't think, though, that... I mean, I think that's a classic example of the type of myth that the movie perpetuates, which is that women are above all manipulative.
Yes.
It's
like the sitcom wife to the nth degree. Like, I'm going to stop you from playing golf until you realize it was good for you. And now we're happy.
And it's that kind of idea that, like, a woman will do anything to get married, but the minute you get married, then the real monster comes out and now you're trapped and you can't get out. Which actually, thinking about this, I was thinking about Juno. Because that movie, which I think is very different, and I respect Diablo Cody.
I love that
But that movie has a slightly similar idea with the wife. In
Jennifer Garner character?
Right.
That's one of the best roles ever.
Although I think that what that movie does that Gone Girl doesn't do is it presents that very much as a...
human being.
A human being and a marriage that was good and then wasn't good.
Sour.
And it presents the husband as deeply defective as well.
That's a great counterpoint.
But
both of those characters, like, the husband is obviously the one to blame, but it's for very human reasons.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't want to let go of his youth, and she's ready to mature, and which is a thing that totally happens in relationships and is representative of real life, which this book is not.
I think also this bit of the book kind of, it sort of has that idea that women won't naturally like all of these things, because what women naturally like is getting married, having babies, cuddling on the couch, watching Desperate Housewives.
Gilmore Girls.
It's a kind of, like, women's true interests are very traditional.
Yeah, which is anything, like, completely hypothetical for the age we live in now where things aren't really marketed. They're maybe marketed at the fringes to gender on lines, but the access to almost all information and entertainment is equal along gender lines.
I mean, I guess there are some people who would say in some ways that that's true of, you know, maybe celebrities. I think Jennifer Lawrence, for example, is playing a similar type of public role. She wants to be everything to everyone. Or, you know, like actors who will say, oh, I eat like 10 cheeseburgers a day. Like, I love to eat.
Oh, it's that classic. I'm really a nerd underneath. I'm just a nerd. Like, I'm a beautiful supermodel. But when I go home, I just want to play like Nintendo 64 and drink beer.
Exactly. And I think there's a difference between that and thinking that all women do this and they do it to manipulate.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between presenting a public image as a celebrity, which is an act of manipulation, both male and female.
Sure.
And just that, like, women are going to lie about liking cheeseburgers to get you to marry them.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's very much like beer commercial psychology of genders.
Right.
But, and then the question remains, like, does Gillian Flynn believe this?
I think so. I think so. This is her empowered moment in the novel where she feels like she's saying...
She's transcending this, like, fraud, this facade that she's put up, yeah. and she's becoming her true self.
She has a big truth that she wants yeah. the reader to be like, that's totally how it is.
Yeah.
And I also think what, at least what she's touching on is a far more complex thing than the way she's... Obviously, I haven't read the context of that, but there's a lot more to be said about it, I think, about how women choose to self-present, and that's a complicated discussion. Sure. And I think by reducing it, she's making it harmful.
Yeah. But I think this backwards mindset is represented in the culture. There was a article apparently on Men's Health magazine yesterday that like cited a, you know, a PhD, a teacher in a PhD program at, you know, the University of Santa Barbara who's saying like, if you want your girlfriend to care about football, don't talk to her about the stats. Talk to her about the storylines because that's what they connect with. And like the article was like, how to talk to any woman about football as if no woman could understand the draw of football yeah. beyond like the storylines. And...
Or as if like that's not just, you know, if, like if someone doesn't like football, they don't like football.
Sure.
If someone loves football, they love football. I mean, I don't know if there are like how to talk to your husband about babies or something, you know, like yeah. cooking or like watching The View. Like I think that's just a drawing lines about yeah. it's I think it's harmful to both men and women.
Painting very broad strokes.
Yeah, and it really like has this idea that there are interests that men and women should have.
Yeah.
And there are ways that they should interact with each other, which is very limiting, I think.
And I wonder if that's, like, symptomatic of because we are now so pressed for time and our time is so competed for that we are only able to, like, process information broadly.
Yeah.
And, like, we need, like, the generalities in order to connect with anything so we can move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
That might be a part of it. I don't know. That's for another podcast. So we're gonna close with some mystery thriller books that you would recommend people read instead of Gone Girl.
I see you skipped over the handsome Ben Affleck.
I'm embarrassed of it
comment
now.
That's just for you privately.
We can go back. How is Ben Affleck so handsome? I was just wondering at the time, but it seems ridiculous.
I actually don't know if Ben Affleck is that handsome. Is he that handsome?
You need to elaborate on that.
Well, many... straight men seem to think Ben Affleck is extremely handsome. Is there something...
I count myself as one of them.
Is he as handsome as John Hamm? That's my question to you.
I would say they're equally handsome.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
With maybe a 0.5 differential between them either way.
I think that what you said earlier about Ben Affleck's smile affects...
His handsomeness.
Quite true, and it affects his handsomeness.
Do you think John Hamm smiles with his whole face?
I don't know. I think John Hamm is... probably going to smile too much, if anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, John Hamm in real life is so, I think, different than...
The Mad Men.
Than Don Draper.
Yeah.
That he's this, like, dude who's really into alt comedy and stuff. It makes
yeah.
it a different dynamic. Yeah. But, like, Ben Affleck is, like, trying to be a serious director, and he's
yeah.
married to Jennifer Garner, and there's this very public relationship.
There's something about Ben Affleck I'm not... personally appreciating his handsomeness, but
I might have been in your camp. I was visiting, this is a personal anecdote, I was visiting Los Angeles, I guess, whenever The Town was out,
right.
and I went to go see The Town, and I was stoned, my friend Michelle, and we were watching the movie, and she, like halfway through, you know, I was just enjoying it, and she just turns to me, and she's like, how is Ben Affleck so handsome? And,
it hit me
in a moment of, like, pure revelation. I was just, like, in shock for the rest of the movie.
It was like The Wizard of Oz turning into color.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
I've seen...
It was like The Giver with, yeah. with the rose or the apple or whatever. It's like I saw the reality behind the illusion.
Well,
it was pure handsomeness on a level that I could have never again glimpsed.
I will wait for my... revelatory Ben
yeah.
Affleck.
But even on Bill Maher on Friday, I was just like flabbergasted by his handsomeness.
I respect
his head
Ben Affleck so much more now, and I guess yeah. that's a whole other conversation. But I guess I never thought much about Ben Affleck, and now I feel...
He's a hyper-eloquent, extremely informed person,
yes.
which I find great because he looks really presidential.
Yes.
So I'm hoping in like 20 years
really?
He'll run. I mean, he's back to fucking Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
He seems
why
to be on the right. He seems to be on the right page about everything.
Yeah.
Do you disagree? Would you vote for Ben Affleck if it was Ben Affleck versus Chuck Norris? Who would you vote for?
I would absolutely vote for Ben Affleck in that situation.
Ben Affleck versus Dinesh D'Souza.
I don't know. I I'm not sure that, I mean, should actors run for president? I guess that's a whole other...
Well, I guess you would have to believe that the people who run for president aren't already actors.
No, I think they are actors, but totally. They're also...
Why not have someone who's genuine about it, then?
You think they're qualified? I mean, at least, you know, some of them have a understanding of constitutional law.
Maybe Elizabeth Warren, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, Ben Affleck, 2020...
Let's see what year can we make. Maybe 2022?
Yeah, 2022.
Well, I guess it would be 2024. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe so Ben Affleck for vice president, maybe?
Oh, you don't do and much. Clooney as president?
Yeah, very possible.
They have similar political views.
Yeah, that could happen.
That's a dangerously handsome combination.
It would be too handsome for the rest of the world.
It would be like a 90% whatever fucking party that they found, the new Whig party.
Yeah, I think that would frighten other countries.
Oh, it should.
It might start a crazy cold war of electing handsome presidents.
If there's anything that
can
restore the United States to its hegemonic dominance of the previous century, it's that. But yeah, so let's recommend some mystery thriller books that people could read instead of Gone Girl.
I think that one of the best mystery thriller writers, and an excellent writer in general, is Patricia Highsmith. I think if people want to read a character who does terrible things and is completely... disastrous with everything they touch and is evil and is manipulative, but there is understanding and a real sense of that character, they should read The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Okay.
I think Tom Ripley is potentially the type of character this movie wanted Amy to be.
Sure.
And we don't have... By not knowing
duplicitous, two-faced, able exactly. to live two lives.
And a psychopath. Tom Ripley is a sociopath.
Yeah.
But
he's a sociopath for, like, very specific, I think, cultural and economic forces yes. that this movie attempts to, like, build as her foundation for her sociopathy, but never really does.
And I also think he's a true sociopath in the sense that he's a charming sociopath, at least to the reader. He plays
you
on self-pity.
You can see how people want him around.
Yeah, or you can see, you feel bad for him when they don't want him around. You really think, like, fuck them. Like, who are they to reject Tom Ripley's company, even when he's doing... And you really
Even when
feel,
he's whacking them across the face
right,
with an oar.
And you feel wronged by the other characters who really haven't done... anything wrong. You think, Jude Law, what a dick. Why isn't he nicer? Mm-hmm. I know his name is not Jude Law in the book, but Dickie Greenleaf, what an idiot. Why isn't he nicer?
His name
to
isn't
Tom
Jude
Ripley?
Law in the
no,
book?
No.
Spoiler.
I think generally Patricia Highsmith was a master of thrillers. Strangers on a Train.
Oh.
The Price of Salt, which was an early lesbian novel, I think. It's kind of a thriller, it's kind of not a thriller, but it's a great book. And if people like stalkers, obsessive stalkers, she has a book called This Sweet Sickness, which is a beautiful, obsessive stalker novel.
Yeah. And I think that Tom Ripley is a social climber.
Right.
Is kind of a fun thing in relation to this movie and book, because there's a really weird reading. You can read it as, like, she's trying to... help their economic circumstances because now they're, like, national celebrities.
Yes.
And, like, his failing bars now. Like, they, like, drive by. I remember in the movie, there's a huge line outside with everyone taking selfies, and she has now, like, legitimized this failed economic state of their marriage.
Yeah, and there's also a real... there's a scene in The Talented Mr. Ripley, and it's one of the best moments in the book, where Tom Ripley talks about knowing people. And he says, you know, one of the strangest things is that you can never really know someone. And that
How is that not works, the epigraph for Gone Girl?
That works wonderfully in The Talented Mr. Ripley. And it comes at a moment of plot really happening and an emotional plot really happening. The active and the emotional plot coming together. But as the workshop says, but I don't think that ever happens. In Gone Girl, and I don't think that theme is ever successfully. And I really think it's about characters. We are not inside or close to a character at any time, so it's not real.
That's a beautiful note to end on. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah.